This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Alberta Griffin won the Democratic primary for the state house district that includes most of the city of Portage, along with Oshtemo, Schoolcraft, Prairie Ronde, and Texas townships. Now she is challenging Republican Representative Brant Iden in the 61st state house district. Alberta Griffin, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What are the top things that you would want to work on if you do get elected to the state house?
Well, I think my primary goal is to be able to give support to our families and our community, making sure that we are protecting educational standards, ensuring that our families feel safe within their community, focusing on infrastructure and improving water quality throughout Kalamazoo County. Also, spending a lot of time looking at how we can build better community ties and bring in support with regards to healthcare.
Why don't we start with water quality, because that's been quite an issue in Southwest Michigan, especially in Parchment, where the high levels of PFASs were found. What do you think is the thing that a state lawmaker should be working on right now or focusing on when it comes to PFASs and other types of water contamination?
Well, first, I want to say that, you know, within my district as well, we had three wells that were considered with elevated PFAS levels. So this is really a countywide issue. Although it's most prevalent in the Parchment area, what we found within the surrounding districts is that, you know, there are some concerns there as well. One thing that we, you know, should be focusing on is the infrastructure with regard to public health. And having been in public health for the last 20 years, some of those discretionary funds that have been decreased and cause a loss of jobs in this community with regard to public health should be a focus for us, that we have health officials that are continuously looking at these levels and making appropriate recommendations based on that. We do know that there were reports that came in from 2010 that were discussing these elevated levels. And without the support and funding to be able to continue to keep track of it, you know, it's easily that things can fall through, you know, the cracks. And so that's what I would like to focus on, is ensuring that we have those supports in place so that we don't have those issues anymore.
Education standards, you mentioned in your opening answer as well. Something that, you know, I hear a lot from teachers, including my own children's teachers, is that there's too much emphasis on testing. So what's the right way to figure out what schools are performing well so that, you know, the state can either use them as models of how other schools should operate or perhaps to make changes if a school is not educating students as well as they should?
Well, whenever I think about education, I think about equity and then the equitable distribution of resources within communities. And so when we look at a school that is underperforming with regard to testing, we also need to look at the other factors that go into those end results. And I think we've lost track of that concept and to be able to bring that back in because, you know, if we looked at a school system, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, when there was more equitable distribution, there was more diversity within schools. We're seeing a systemic change in that over this period of time. So, yes, the testing is overwhelming, but it also is indicative to, you know, how the schools get funding. What we have to do is start to look at a balance between the time for testing and then the quality of care that the students have and the teachers receive while they're in the classroom throughout the school year. So it's a different way of thinking about what we've done over the last 20 years.
Right. So if it's not going to be standardized testing or as much standardized testing, maybe less standardized testing, what are the other ways then that the state can evaluate what the school is doing? What are the metrics and the benchmarks you do look at?
Well, what's really interesting about that is there's a lot of research that shows you know, when we get to educational attainment post and then graduation rates as well, also either are a red flag or a green flag for how well a community is doing. Looking at the end game, right? So spending time, not just looking at what the kids are doing that specific year, but also finding measurement systems that allow for us to see how children change and improve over the course of a year. So if a student starts in third grade and their reading level is in second grade, you know, do we measure success by that student getting to grade reading level, or that they are still falling behind the other students that may be slightly ahead? And so that's what I think about when I think about testing an individual within classroom. I think about my own children, and they each have different levels and capabilities, strengths and weaknesses. And our teachers have been trained to be able to assess that as well. So moving the standard, not decreasing the standard, but changing the way that we measure standards, I think is something that should be in the forefront of our minds.
You mentioned infrastructure. Does the state need to institute any new fees or taxes, or increase any fees or taxes to provide more money for infrastructure improvements and construction?
Well, I mean, to begin with, I think that we have a robust tax system that allows for us to be able to make a lot of different changes within the structure itself. It's how we distribute that money. And there has been discussion about me in wanting to increase the taxes within our constituency, and that isn't true. What I believe is that we have to have a way to distribute those funds that we're already putting into the system and allow for it to be used in a way that most fits our community. So when we look at an infrastructure system and we look at employing, like, for instance, another health official that is in charge of looking at our water quality, whether we take some of those funds from already dollars that are coming into our community to allow for that and decrease in another area because of a need, I think that makes really good sense.
But I suppose there would be a lot of communities who would look around and say, you know, we don't have a lot of dimes and nickels to spare. As things stand right now, we're spending our budget. We have other needs. So does that mean that roads, if you're going to put more money to roads, you have to decide what else it is that you're not going to do or do less of?
Well, and we do that now already. So, I mean, those are the discretionary funds that I was talking about. And, you know, with our CDBG grants and our CSBG grants, as well as, you know, we have been fortunate that we have, the Imagine Kalamazoo, which is allowing for us to be able to fix some of the issues within our infrastructure road-wise. So it allows our community to have a little bit more leeway. And I think we need to think about those options as not like a siloed dollars, but an opportunity to be able to provide for the things that our constituents think are the most important.
The state's formula for distributing money to local governments for road funding, Public Act 51, actually passed in 1951 originally. It's been amended somewhat since then. But do you think that is worth looking at, that maybe that needs to be redone, that there has to be a different way of determining where money should be going for local governments in Michigan to do road repairs, et cetera?
Well, I think there's always room for change if change is necessary. And as we look at the original documentation, we've done that with several different reauthorization acts from our school lunch programs to, like you just said, for our roads. And we address that as needed. And, you know, we have to look at the infrastructure itself. We have to look at the individuals that are choosing to put things in priority. And that's part of the reason why I'm running for office, because if we're not taking relevant data and information that's right in front of us and making informed decisions about it, we'll continue to do the same things and have the same results. And we're seeing that in our roads, in our school lunch issues with regard to our water quality. It's not just a singular event. It's across the board status quo that I feel like we can make some changes in.
Do you think that the amount of money that the state is collecting and dispersing right now for roads is right? I mean, you say you don't want to raise taxes. So is this the amount of money that the state is going to have for roads for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think that, you know, looking at the information in full detail would be, you know, the wisest choice for me to do once in the legislature. But I also, we also have an anomaly in this community that is singular, a singular event that's different than the rest of the state. And so I think we take that into account because we do have an influx of dollars from, you know, this Foundations for Excellence that is doing a lot of this internal infrastructure related work. We see it in our roads right now. We see it in some of the initiatives that they have to change Kalamazoo in 2025. So I would begin by looking at what is already occurring within our community and what funds have been allocated for us before I would make an informed decision about where we would go next with that.
The Foundation for Excellence, though, is in the city of Kalamazoo. Are you saying that there is some ripple effect from that, or are you?
I do believe that I do see ripple effects because I live here in Portage, and I have seen the work on West Edge. I've seen the work. I've seen the work on 12th Street, which is a street that's right near my home. There are provisions that are being made to work with our community across the board. And so that's something, like I said, I would want to be able to take a deeper dive and a closer look at in order to ensure that we, you know, everyone within the community is getting what they need. Because folks, when we're talking about infrastructure right now, I think more importantly, not saying that our roads do not matter because they absolutely do, but I think people are looking at water quality. I think they're looking at lead levels. I think they're looking at those other infrastructure-related items that have you know been relatively on the back burner for the last few years. So that is a concern of mine, and that's a concern of my constituents. That we're taking a look at that. We're looking at lead levels within our school systems. We're looking at lead levels. We're looking at water quality in our actual classrooms. And so when I think about infrastructure, that would be the first thing that at this present time that I would want to make sure that I'm, you know, quelling fears about.
Can the state continue its current auto insurance system, which allows for lifetime benefits for people who are seriously injured in auto accidents? Can that system continue with any reduction in rates, or does the current auto rates we have, which are very high compared to the rest of the nation, just come along with the idea of a lifetime benefit for people who suffer serious injuries?
Well, I definitely think we need to revisit that because of the fact that we have some of the highest rates within the country. We need to take a deep look at why that is, as well as how we can mitigate that. I have, you know, just like anybody else, if you have two cars, you know, you're paying quite a bit of money. And we also have an issue with folks because of how expensive it is, don't always insure their own vehicles. And so there's definitely something to look at there and ensure that we're doing the right thing by our Michiganders and particularly my constituents.
So are you open to the idea that lifetime benefits may have to end, or that people should have the option perhaps of purchasing insurance that doesn't include lifetime benefits?
Well, I do believe that options are really important. So we have the same options when we're choosing life insurance for ourselves and our family members, like the rate, the level, and the amount. And so to be able to allow that same thing for automobiles makes sense. But like I said, I would want to take a closer look at that to ensure that, you know, it's going to work, what's going to work the best for my constituency.
But you are open to that idea?
I am.
At least exploring it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You mentioned that people should feel safe in their communities. What would the state do so that people do feel safe?
Well, I think with transparency and open communication has been something that has been a concern when we're on the doors. People want to know what's going on in their community. They also want to be able to have a conversation about their concerns, specifically when it comes to guns in schools and making sure that their children are safe when they walk into their classroom or if they're walking down the street. And so, you know, having someone that is willing to address those concerns and talk with them about that within my community has been a primary focus. I feel like as a mother and as a parent of school age children, we, you know, and this, you know, obviously a person that has a family, you know, making sure that people feel like that they are visible, that their concerns are being heard, allows for them to feel safer in their community. And we have a wonderful sheriff's department that does as much as they can to ensure that our communities feel safe, but also keeping communication lines open for individuals to be able to voice those concerns is something that I think people have felt like they haven't had in quite some time.
Specifically, though, if you are in the state legislature, would you vote for any additional restrictions on guns, be it, you know, carrying them in schools or anything else in terms of, you know, who can own a gun and what sort of gun they can own?
Right. And so I've spoken about that before. I do believe the Second Amendment is an important amendment. I personally, along with my children, my family is a family of folks that go hunting in November. We catch our deer and we, you know, get our venison and they also have had experience and training and owning and utilizing a firearm. And it's something that has been a family tradition. And I know that there are a lot of people in the community that are the exact same way. We also have folks that do not believe that should be something that individuals should have. What I do think should be in place are restrictions for individuals that have, there should be a vetting process just like anything else so that we have some, and also have common sense gun control regulation and reform to allow for us to screen people a little bit closer when they're deciding to make that decision to purchase a firearm.
So in terms of vetting, let's talk a little bit about mental health. What can the state do to improve mental health treatment, screening, et cetera?
Well, so that, you know, obviously for me, it's a loaded question with how we deal with individuals that have mental health concerns. You know, we have to, first of all, reduce the stigma that mental health is directly all the time associated with gun violence. We know that there's domestic violence issues and general violence issues that come along with gun violence. And an individual that may have a mental health issue doesn't necessarily need to be restricted from owning a firearm. And, you know, it's one of the reasons why we have had a lifelong community-wide concerns about these folks and that stigma, and they also don't talk about the fact that they have a mental health concern. Reducing that stigma is vitally important to me, alongside with ensuring that individuals are vetted for the use of a firearm. Someone in one phase of their life may not have access to a firearm, but that does not mean that they should in perpetuity without, you know, obviously a violent crime, be allowed to restrict it from their Second Amendment right.
You mentioned transparency a moment ago. Should the governor and the legislature be subject to the Freedom of Information Act?
Well, I have to say yes, and I have been FOIA'd. So I have been FOIA'd several times, and being a public servant, and I believe that, like we said, transparency is absolutely vital. I had no problem with releasing that information. Obviously, as a professor at Western, it is a nonprofit organization. It allows for any organization to be able to FOIA me, and I believe that everyone should be held to that same standard.
Is there anything else you would want to do to improve government transparency?
Well, I think that, you know, beginning with that, you know, discussion of keeping, if you're choosing to be a public servant, you know, you're exposing yourself obviously to, you know, the public eye, and that our constituents want to know that you are a person of integrity and you are a person that is willing to represent them, but also that you are a human being. You know, perfection is not the key, is not the end game, but it definitely is, having, you know, integrity is. And so, you know, there have been attacks on me with regard to my integrity. And what's really interesting that came along with those attacks was the level of transparency that I've had through the course of my campaign.
So it's
Yeah,
I was going to get into that a little bit. So yeah, people have probably seen these ads by now. They say you didn't pay your taxes. Give us the story. Tell us your side of the story of what happened there.
Yeah. So I actually, obviously, I'm a small business owner. I have, just like with anyone else that owns a small business, you pay your monthly taxes and you keep track of, you know, what you estimate to be the total taxable dollars that you'll have to pay for the work that you do. And I had a very good year once, a little while ago, and my taxes estimated out to be a little bit more than I had assumed. And so I went on a tax payment plan, just like any small business owner does, and I'm paying that debt. I'm paying it in full. And what people don't know, they say, well, I'm not paying my taxes, or I've, you know, tons and tons of dollars out. And it's a very small amount, comparatively less than $4,000 that I owe in my taxes, although the amount to begin with was high because of a good year. And obviously, I took care of my staff and my team, and I'm paying my debt. And I you know, I'm making good on what I said that I would do. And I believe that any person that has a small business, any person that is working and taking care of their family, and also believes that you should pay your taxes, can understand that exactly what I'm doing. What I find to be the most unnerving thing about the situation is that it was an attack on my character for being transparent. It was an attack on my character, and it definitely affected my family. But the funny thing is that it does not affect my integrity, because the folks that are around me that know who I am and have worked with me for all of these years, many, many, many organizations in this community, were not pleased by the fact that you would dig that deeply and attack a woman that is a single mother, a business owner, an employer, for having a good year.
Just to understand how this all happened, did you realize that you didn't have the money to pay the taxes and then contact the IRS, or were you late in paying?
No. It's what you do when you file your taxes at the end of the year. This is pretty simple, standard things. Like you go through and you estimate the amount of money that you may owe. And when you estimate that amount of money owed, you, just like anyone else, is allowed to create a repayment plan. And that is exactly what I've done. So I've just created a repayment plan with the IRS and have made the payment on a monthly basis.
And was this covering last year?
It's covered a couple of years. It's covered a couple of years. And it's, you know, and like I said, I was aware that, you know, that I was making these payments and, you know, possibly could have been hit about the fact that it happened. So, and that's unfortunate, but, you know, like I get the notice every single month and I make the payment just like I should. So, and any person that has a small business that may get a 1099 from an organization for doing contract work has the exact same type of scenario that I have. And so usually when you don't have, when you work for a larger group and the taxes are taken out already for you, they estimate that for you and you may get a tax return. That's not the case for me. I estimate the amount that I'm going to get taken out and then make my payments accordingly.
When do you expect to have it paid off in full?
Should not even be the end of this year. Like, it should be within before the end of this year.
You wrote
it's a very small amount.
You wrote a blog post called "The Debt Shaming of Alberta Griffin." What do you mean by debt shaming?
I think that they debt shamed me for being an entrepreneur, but not being a sizable enough entrepreneur that has millions of dollars in debt. They did the same thing to Stacey Abram. For having student loan debt and also having back taxes. Yet we can have folks that are millions of dollars in debt, filed bankruptcy, and not have to pay back their debt. And yet, for someone like me that decided, me, a woman of color, a business owner, a longtime community servant, somehow it makes me a hypocrite to have to pay my taxes back. And yet, I earned my business, I created my business on my own work, my own blood, sweat, and tears. And for some reason, that makes me a hypocritical individual. And it's an attack on my character to say that that a woman and a mother and a single mother cannot be an entrepreneur without without having some negative connotation to it. I think that there is a time and a place for having a conversation with a person, but to publicly shame an individual for their entrepreneurial spirit and finding a gap in the community and filling that gap, not in a commercial way. That's the funny thing about my company, is that it is focused on improving the human condition. I work with nonprofits, groups that don't necessarily have the funding to be able to have a data scientist at their disposal or a team of data scientists at their disposal, much more work that's focused on improving our communities and making them better. And for some reason, that work, the work itself, and the income that I received from that work makes me a bad person.
This is a state house district which has traditionally been Republican. As long as anyone can remember, they have voted for Republicans. Of course, it's shifted around a bit over the decades when there's been new legislative districts, but still Republican. So what do you think you offer people that might get them to consider changing the way they have been voting for a long time?
Well, I think from what I just said before, people that are working every day in this community, they're like me. They are like me. They have families, they have small businesses, they have side businesses to help them make ends meet. They have an entrepreneurial spirit the same way that I do. And they understand that I'm working for them because I'm working with them in the community, and I have for 20 years. And I know I said this before when we had a discussion, but people will vote for the person and not the party. And we've seen that happen repeatedly. And at this point in time, representation matters. Someone that is doing the same work that they're doing every day and will go to Lansing and to fight for them, that matters. And I'm that person.
Alberta Griffin is the Democratic candidate for State House in the 61st District. That includes most of the city of Portage, along with Oshtemo, Prairie Rond, Schoolcraft, and Texas Townships. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.